While Andrew and Craig believe the joy of discovery is crucial to enjoying any well-told tale, they will not shy away from spoiling specific story beats when necessary. Plus, these are books you should have read by now.
Introduce this very special guest episode of
Thank You Guys
Overdue.
How feeling?
I thought we were already rolling. I thought we were going.
Are we? No, we need to. It's we're mixing it up, and we need to let people know. We need to get the word out. We need to raise awareness.
Your regular fans are gonna scream.
Can you change your Facebook pictures to a Sailor Moon character to raise awareness for this third person on our podcast?
That would be great. Who are you talking to? Me?
Yeah.
Yeah, you guys. We got to raise awareness. We got to get the word out.
I can do that.
I'm calling Sailor Jupiter. You're trying to say that Jocko being here is a problem? What are you saying?
No, I'm just saying we need to raise awareness. Awareness, Craig. It's like you didn't even go to a liberal arts college.
Yeah. Conservative arts.
I did go to a conservative arts college. Welcome to Overdue. This is a podcast about the books that you've been meaning to read. My name is Craig.
And my name is Andrew.
And my name's Jocko.
Whoa.
Whoa, who's this guy? How did he get in here? We hear you asking.
I just snuck right in.
And the answer is that he's one of Craig's friends and he reads books too sometimes. Yay.
Andrew doesn't like him at all, but he's going to tolerate
him. I'm only friends with Craig.
I like him fine. We are acquaintances. I don't even think we've met in real life.
No.
Is this the first time you've ever seen each other's faces?
I mean, I've seen pictures of his face.
Yeah. I've looked at a lot of pictures, but...
And really, I mean, how many pictures?
Well, we've brought you here, Andrew, to tell you that Jocko's been reading your books of pictures of you for the podcast.
Yes. Books you've been meaning to read. Picture book. Yikes. Of...
I don't like that news at all.
we've been talking a little while about having some guests on the show. And we like Jocko, so we wanted to bring him on, and he was interested in reading a book that I don't know that either of us were going to tackle anytime soon.
I don't think so.
Which is The Stand by Stephen King. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah, I read The Stand. I have it's a monstrous book of fiction. And this is the complete and uncut edition.
Oh, whoa.
Is there a cut edition?
I think that's the regular edition.
The regular edition
was...
This is the Stephen King director's cut. He, there's a little preface in the beginning explaining why originally he had cut the book down. And there's about 300 extra pages in this book.
Is it all the preface?
Yes, 300 pages of preface where he says he does cool one-liners in it.
Wait, he does cool one-liners or he says he does cool one-liners?
No, he writes cool one-liners in his own preface. He's talking about how a story with non-essential parts cut out is still a story, but he writes, "The story is there, but it's not elegant. It's like a Cadillac with the chrome stripped off and the paint sanded down to dull metal. It goes somewhere, but it ain't, you know, boss." And that's in his preface, so...
What is that? Are you even being for real right now?
No, boss is italicized as well.
Man, that is the attitude of somebody who does not need to have editors anymore. Because, like, I've been on both sides of that writer editor fence, and there's some tension there. Like, sometimes somebody will take a semicolon out of a paragraph that I did, and I'll feel like they've murdered my firstborn child. But, at the end of the day, I recognize that they perform an essential service.
But
without editors, like, all the Harry Potter books would have been terrible and not just the last few of them.
That's true. The interesting thing about this story, though, is that it wasn't edited for editorial reasons. So it's amazing. It's the reason that it was edited was because of the accounting department. who did the math when this book first came out, which was in the late 70s, I believe, 79 or 80, who did the math when this book first came out and realized that the asking price, the most that they could ask for a Stephen King book was $12.95. And if the book was as long as it is now in the copy that I hold, in its first printing, they would have had to charge too much and nobody would have bought, nobody would purchase.
That's awesome.
Jocko has already proven himself to be better researched than either of us usually are.
I just read the preface. It's not a big deal.
Hold on. I think we're doing too much good work right away. I think we need to cool our jets. Why are you reading this book, Jocko? Okay, what is your frame of reference for books in general?
Never read them. Never wanted to.
Great.
You started with The Stand, and I kind of liked it, so I might keep going. No, I'm an avid reader of fiction, I would call myself. I love, like, junk fiction and, I don't know, Michael Crichton crap. Like, I just love it. I really enjoy it. I tell people that my favorite book that I read last year was Jurassic Park. And I read contemporary books as well, but I just really had a good time. So that's the type of stuff I like, you know, yeah. It's just like banal, exactly. If I can read something that is sitting on a paperback shelf and involves some form of maybe outside magic or strangeness to it, then I'm interested. I can't really dig
into inside,
those
not inside magic.
No, outside magic. I can't dig into those big, huge, like, fantasy epics that, like, only fantasy fans read. I'm a pop kind of guy, I guess.
You're saying is, like, less Game of Thrones and more, like, novels that take place in the world that we live in, except somebody figured out how to clone dinosaurs, or somebody made piano that talks, or, like, some...
Right. Or like an old magician and a young magician live in England in the late 1800s, like stuff like that.
Which book is that?
Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. Yeah.
Oh, that's like a real book though.
Yeah, that's a real book. It's good though. Yeah.
Yeah. I was expecting like some weird like genre trash wizard story.
But I do love genre trash, and especially I like old genre trash, like weird.
All right.
Old books that, anyway.
On the spectrum from genre trash to Michael Crichton trash, where would you put The Stand?
Stephen King is his own sort of, he's outside of that paradigm for me.
Okay.
But definitely right up near Michael Crichton trash. That's I prefer Stephen King way more than... I really prefer him to Michael Crichton, for sure. But I've read a lot of Stephen King, and this is one of those books that I've just always been meaning to read of his in particular. Like, my mother has told me I have to read it. My friends have told me that if I like Stephen King, I should read The Stand. So,
did you get your appreciation for Stephen King from your mom?
Yes. Is that okay to say?
I know it's a weird question, but I say that as someone who read a lot of Stephen King in like middle school because I was borrowing them off my mom's shelf.
Right.
And Stephen King?
Moms love Stephen King. I mean, this is kind of a mom book. Like, it's great.
Wait, we need to keep that through line. I want you, as we talk about this book for the rest of the podcast, to tell me why this is a mom book.
To always be thinking moms love Stephen King. Yeah.
Yeah, always everything in the context of moms.
Cool. No problem. This is exactly how I imagined this podcast would go. This is perfect.
Good. Great. All right. So start us off. What is this book about? Now that we know why you read it, because your mom told you to. So.
Exactly. Perfect. I seem super cool. The book is about a government-engineered plague that they're testing called Project Blue that gets through a millisecond of a computer error ends up getting off of the secret base where it had broken free of its vial, basically, through human error.
Okay.
That starts a chain of events that end with, you know, sort of the cessation of all of most human life.
Okay.
So that's basically... this was like a lawyer book.
No, that's what I thought
you
too.
Didn't think it was a lawyer book.
No, I seriously did because it's called The Stand. I thought the it was stand. Like Please Take the Stand. I thought it was a legal thriller.
No. That's what I thought a few years back, and then this is definitely not that.
Okay.
Definitely not that.
Craig, did you honestly think that, Andrew? I'm sorry, I got
yeah,
so mad
I did,
at you.
Did. No, I did. I did no I research so at all, and I just thought good. It was a legal thing. Even though knowing Stephen King is all about like monsters that are common objects, like I don't know.
Are you basing all of that off of that one book where the bad guy was a car?
Christine.
Maybe
or whatever.
I know his early stuff is different.
It's all about
from
cars.
His later stuff, because his early stuff was about like an author breaking in, and his later stuff has been like, oh, here's Stephen King again. Now it's a scary lamp. Everybody, watch out for the lamp. Anyway, Jocko, continue with your.
Yeah. So the plague hooks up with this scary lamp, and they go on a. No, the plague breaks out because this guy who works at the army base. Freaks out, and due to a computer malfunction, the gates, the walls that shut down, don't shut down in time enough to stop him from getting out. So he doesn't know that he's been infected with this virus that everyone calls Captain Trips. I don't know why, but everyone calls this virus Captain Trips. And this
like
begins.
A good name for a cat.
It's yeah, actually, yes, it is. And so he gets very, very sick with the flu very quickly, and it's a super flu, basically. That's the whole gist of it, that it's this intense flu that makes you sick, and then the science behind it in the story is that it is a constantly shifting virus, that every time the body shifts to fight, every time the body changes to fight it, it shifts, and it can shift on the dime. And it has a 90, it's been genetically engineered so that it has a 99% communicability rate.
Gross.
Yeah. And they do a really great job in the beginning of showing people just not being careful and not taking it seriously. Mm. We get tons and tons of scenes of people who have come in contact with someone who has it. And then we see that they've got a scratchy throat, or a doctor takes somebody's, like looks at somebody's throat and then just with a tongue depressor. And then just throws the tongue depressor in the garbage. So we get all these really sort of dreadful scenes of people not taking this seriously because they don't know that this is going to be the flu that will end humanity. To them, they just figure that it's the flu.
So how much of the book is the process of this breakdown? Because to jump ahead...
I actually broke this all down.
What?
I broke it all down as a psycho.
Do you have a pie chart? You realize this is radio.
Yeah, you can see here.
It's like internet radio.
It's, yeah, it's not the same. But the first, about the first third of the book is this plague going. And another cool thing that he does is that he introduces us to like 20 different characters. We meet a huge swath of characters, boyfriends and girlfriends, parents and children, and we get the sort of classic in-depth Stephen King characterization where we know what they had for breakfast and why they chose that item for breakfast, right?
And what it says about them as a person.
And what it says about them as a person, yeah. But the interesting thing about it is that all of those characters start to drop off one by one. And it's a funneling down of main characters into this, like, it's actually super sad, the whole book. But it's a funneling down of characters to a core, you know, maybe 8 characters. And we meet more along the way, and then we lose some, and it's this sort of a constant ebb and flow. But by the middle of the book, we've got our 6 or 7 main protagonists and our 3 main antagonists.
Okay.
So that's the start of the book. And that's not really what drives it. So it's this interesting type of apocalypse where things are falling apart and there's nothing left. There's nobody left, but it's not like it was due to an atomic bomb or a zombie outbreak or anything like that. Most everyone just dropped dead. So they don't have to worry about gas. There's gas all over the place. They don't really have to worry about food. There's canned food all over the place. And they are now like, I don't know the exact percentages. It doesn't say the exact percentages, but it's like you're looking at probably about 2% of the population in the United States is left alive after this.
Why are they still there?
It's not explained. It's not really
explained. Good job, Stephen King.
One of those flukes where people are immune because you can't just kill everybody and still have a story left.
Yeah.
It is that. I mean, it is. There are doctors in the end who sort of who say, like, we think that we were just immune. Because there's worry about new children being born at the end, which, you know, we get through. But,
cool.
So we were immune. That was something about us that we... And the thing that they say is that they didn't catch it and then got better. Those who were immune never caught it in the first place. And that was the big... That's the big deciding factor.
So so the book starts to shift. Is it a pretty organic shift? Or is it like, clean break, now we're in this other story?
No, I think the best... The key element of this book, the thing that he does the most elegantly, is this shift into this other type of story. It's easy to do that type of thing when you're dealing with mysticism and magic and stuff, but in the beginning it doesn't even seem like that's what we're dealing with. But about 150, maybe 200 pages in, we get a few paragraphs about this man wearing corduroy, wearing a denim jacket, jeans, and cowboy boots, walking down the road. And it just talks about he doesn't remember how old he is, but he's been around for a while, and he remembers being there when chaos starts happening. And then he says, this is right before the plague really hits and takes everybody down, and he says he can feel it coming, and he can feel the power, and then he levitates a few inches off the ground. And that's the first time we see anything really supernatural happening in this book.
Okay.
So it sounds like
this book is so long because it's several books.
Different books put together? Yes. It's a trilogy.
Yeah.
It's a trilogy, really.
Is it really a trilogy?
No, but it's...
Man, I don't know. I don't know anything about this book.
But it's not really a trilogy, Andrew. It's just one book.
It's not really a trilogy. Normally, the stories you see about, like, diseases outbreaking, it's either the outbreak is a story, or the aftermath of the outbreak is the story, but you don't often spend a ton of time on both. Is that fair?
Right. That's definitely, that's fair. And so this person is this sort of magical evil figure, who doesn't quite know who he is or what his purpose is yet. But the main characters begin having dreams about a man in corduroy or a man wearing dark robes or a man, wearing a black suit. And he's got this smile and these, like, dark, dark eyes. And the dreams fill them with terror. They keep having dreams about the dark man, they call him. He's got a lot of names in this book. His proper name that he goes by is Randall Flagg, which is a recurring character in some of Stephen King's books. He's a recurring villain. But this is his first appearance. Yeah. He is the villain.
Is that name really... Really strikes fear into the heart.
Randall.
Oh no, it's Randall. Oh no, Randy the evil.
But
is he the guy from? Is he in Needful Things?
I don't know, but he is definitely the main villain in the entire Dark Tower series.
Oh,
which is that like gunslinger series thing that he did?
Yeah.
Right. So he becomes a prominent figure in all the protagonist's dreams. They're having bad dreams about him. And then they start having dreams, good dreams, about a 108-year-old black woman living in Kansas, I think, or maybe Oklahoma, in the Midwest. And in their dreams, she just says, come to me if you want, come to me if you want to feel okay, basically. Like, I don't know. It's a little...
I made some grits. Come.
Seriously, though. So they have dreams that they will be fed and taken care of if they go to her little shack that she has, like way out, way out there. And she doesn't suffer any of the ill effects of all the power going out and everything because she's never, like, upgraded to electricity. And she doesn't know why she's lived so long, but she's a minister of God, basically. So God speaks to her. And she's 108, and she goes by Mother Abigail. And all of our protagonists end up eventually sort of making their way to her. And once they make it to her, they head toward Boulder, Colorado. That's the vision that she gets. She knows that they have to go to Boulder, Colorado.
Where else would you go? World's ending. You got to get a sweet high. You go to Boulder, Colorado. That's where you got to go.
Right.
Rocky Mountain High.
Rocky Mountain High. Mentioned in the book. By name.
Like the song?
Yeah. They come across an old ski resort that has a bunch of dead teenagers in it. And one of the characters finds a big trash bag of marijuana. And he says, "What is this?" And the character says, "That's their own version of John Denver's Rocky Mountain High."
Could have just said marijuana. Seems like it would have taken less time to say marijuana.
You know, it's the end of the world. There's like 100 people. No, there's more than that. But there's not many people. They've got time. They can chat.
They've got time to drop awkward cultural references.
Yes. So fast forwarding a little bit because, dear God, this book is 1,300 pages long.
Yeah, please do.
The heroes of the story are all make it to Boulder. The main villain, Randall Flagg, also known as the Dark Man, also known as the Wandering Dude.
No.
Also known as, yeah, the Wandering Dude. And also known as the Walking Dude and the Hard Case.
Which of
it
these?
Sounds like they could have cut like 200 pages out of the book just by picking a name.
Picking one name for him, yeah.
Yeah.
But all those epithets are so boss.
Yeah, they're sweet. The Walking Dude?
Boss,
come on.
The Walking Dude.
Is he wearing a corduroy jacket or a denim jacket?
Denim jacket.
Denim.
I propose that we just call him Bad Randy.
Bad Randy. So,
where's Bad Randy hold up?
Las Vegas.
Oh, snap.
And he gets, like, bad people to come to him. People who are generally bad. Or, it's also mentioned, people who are bad or technologically minded, because he is all about creating a society. Ready for this? He's all about creating a society that is about order and control and getting the trains running on time. And so most of the people that are left living that go to him are technologically capable or good at engineering and things like that. Because these people crave some sort of rigid structure that they won't find in Boulder, because Boulder is sort of this free community. And in Boulder, they try to rebuild society. They try to rebuild a new type of government.
But they're basically, they have that trash can full of weed, so they're just high all the time.
Yeah, they're fine. Yeah.
So how does this go? How does this shake down?
Shakes down with a lot of stuff. There's a kid who's been following them.
The wandering kid?
The wandering kid. No, there's this like a teenager who's one of the central characters who begins to realizes he's been sort of teased the whole time and kind of loses his grip and accepts the dark man into his heart effectively and causes a sabotage that messes with their government in a major way. The Mother Abigail, the good figure, believes that she sinned through the sin of pride, for being prideful, for being the chosen one of God. So she goes out to the woods for a week, and then returns almost starved and dead because she's like 108 years old, for real.
In case you forgot.
Yeah.
Before she went to the woods, someone should have reminded her that she was 108.
Like, hey, you're 108.
Maybe you're not up for this, lady.
Yeah. So she comes back almost dead. Her coming back is such big news that it draws people out of a house that would explode, that moments later explodes. So she saves most of the heroes' lives through that. And she tells the four main protagonists that they have to walk on foot to Las Vegas and stop the Dark Man. Stop Randy Flagg.
Bad Randy.
Bad Randy. Stop Bad Randy.
So wait, what is like inherently bad about Bad Randy's plan for us? Like, it sounds like maybe some order and some trains running on time would be good if only 2% of your population.
Stop playing Randy's advocate, Andrew. Stop it.
So the problem with Randy, classic Randy advocation. The problem with Randy is that he is supernatural.
That's the problem with Randy.
Well, he stares at a guy and the guy goes insane.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that could be a liability.
Anybody who disobeys him in Las Vegas or breaks one of his rules by like using drugs or something, anyone who does that gets crucified. So that's sort of a big problem too. He's totalitarian. Whoa. Right. Yeah, he gets crucified. Or the bad guy, the people that he doesn't like. And the idea is there's this phrase going around that all the old, like this quote from him, from King, saying that all the old toys from the world before the flu are still lying around out there waiting for someone to pick them up. And the idea is that he's building a defense program. He wants to basically rule the whole world eventually. You get that impression. But to start definitely with the country. And the only two civilizations at all are Boulder and Las Vegas. No one else has formed anywhere. They're all sort of migrating because they're all having these dreams.
Do we have any idea what's going on? Do we have any idea what's going on outside of the United States? Or is like all the Russian people like, we're like, we got to go see Randy in Las Vegas?
We don't get an idea of that. There's a mention later on that, Bad Randy is contemplating problems that may arise, and he's like, this is happening too soon. He thinks, like, there's a line that says, he says something along the lines of, he thought he would have to deal with this maybe later, maybe from a dictator in Iran or something.
Weird.
So that leads us to believe that, the flu has killed the whole world. That we know, because when the American government, when all of this country has gone down, someone high up in the military orders the super flu to be released all over the world.
No,
yes.
Terrible plan. You think it would just spread naturally like that? I don't know. That
they say that
kind of implies to me a poor grasp of how like international travel and stuff works. You know, the part of Stephen King, but. Okay. Maybe he just stuck to the U.S. because he couldn't write credibly about anything else. Like, I don't want to cast aspersions, but
right. And he's and the idea with that scene as well is that the U.S. government knows that they will be looked at as the sole blame of this if no one else in the world suffers from it. So they want to make it that. The U.S. government is a petulant baby in this book. And
wait, just in the book? In the book. Snap.
Oh, sick burn. America.
Getting topical.
Got it.
Take that, Obama.
Yeah.
All
right.
Okay, so they got to walk and go. Battles. They got to go tough it out with Randy.
They got to go walk from Boulder, Colorado to Las Vegas, which it takes them, I think, about a month of walking. And Stephen King has definitely mentioned in interviews that one of his inspirations for this book is The Lord of the Rings, that he wanted to tell a Lord of the Rings style epic in America in modern time. So there's a lot of walking in this book. Okay. Walking and great. Motorcycles. Everyone rides motorcycles in this book.
Oh, just like Lord of the Rings.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, that was my favorite part of The Lord of the Rings, too, is all the sections where they're walking and nothing is happening.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what everybody always talks about when they talk about those books, right?
Yep.
It's not like the battle between good and evil and like
walking.
I don't know. All that. It's all the walking and all the eating scenes is all anybody can talk about.
Okay. Exactly. And that's what happens here. They eat a lot of canned food and they walk around. But there's a big sort of final confrontation, which is, should we go into it? I guess. Sure. Why not?
Yeah.
Great. So the sort
what
of
we're here
end,
for is to ruin books for everybody.
Ruin books, and this is one that is only its only merit is its exciting plot. So let's definitely let's end it.
well, if you okay.
I want to come back to that.
Do you not want to? Is this a thing that you think we definitely should not spoil?
I mean, there's there's not a ton of other. There aren't a ton of other reasons to read the book other than the ending, I guess, if that makes sense, or the you know, the story itself.
Okay.
But basically, there's a big a character that we meet midway through named the Trash Can Man.
Stop it.
Man.
Yes. Wants to please Randall Flagg, and in a bizarre turn of events that involves the hand of God himself.
Great.
The foe is for the moment vanquished.
Okay.
So I think that's enough without a. Yeah.
Sure.
But Bad Randy will return.
Bad Randy returns in the last three pages of the book.
Oh,
that's not a spoiler. That's not a spoiler because it's so dumb that it can't.
I thought it was just like the end, and then you turn the last page, and then there's a big question mark just printed on the page all by itself.
Or a big illustration because this book is lightly illustrated.
Is it really? Oh, let's talk about that for a second.
So this illustrator, Bermie Wrightson, who's done a lot of like creepy comics and stuff, like the comic called Creepy, and things like that, for the updated and expanded version. Did these really actually pretty crazy looking illustrations that sort of pepper throughout the book at interesting scenes. And this is the part that I like about it. It's not pivotal scenes necessarily in the book, but it's very clearly Stephen King must have gotten with Bernie and said, any scenes that you think would be interesting, go ahead and draw a picture of. And so there are these really beautiful sort of black and white pen and ink drawings that pepper it throughout. But the first one doesn't come until like 200 pages in, so it's very shocking when this first illustration pops up out of nowhere.
It seems so weird. This book seems, maybe it's because you were reading the uncut, you know, the full
the director's cut,
the full-fledged Manhood edition, that it's like extra long, and who knows? I don't know. What is it?
Mm-hmm.
Is it lumpy? Is it a lumpy
is
book?
Is it lumpy?
Is it uneven? No. That is the surprising thing. That was the surprising thing for me. It's very smooth. I thought I've read It, which is his other 1,000-page book, and that is definitely, I would call that lumpy. It moves and it has exciting parts and less exciting parts. I really enjoyed that book. From start to finish, I think that's probably a better book overall than The Stand. But it's not nearly as smooth as The Stand. It just goes from scene to scene. If you're not in a rush, if you're reading for the enjoyment of reading a weird story, then this book is a real smooth ride.
It sounded
a minute ago like you had issues with things about the book that were not like the story itself. So like maybe the prose itself is not particularly great, or like what doesn't he handle well that makes the story like the only thing worth reading the book for?
Stephen King's prose is an acquired taste, I think. because there are lines in it that you either think, oh, that's cool, or that's ridiculous. For instance, this one, and that's the one problem, is that the prose can sometimes jump out at you with such a, like, it winks at you so hard that it takes you out of the story. He's got a line here, somebody's talking about whether, you know, the flu will kill everyone, and who will be to blame, and this person says, if it had two legs and belt loops, it was a pair of pants, never mind the color. So he throws things like that at you, you know, these little sort of like, if it has two, two legs and belt loops, it was a pair of pants, never mind the color. And there are things like that. And in the, I don't know. Right. So
it's like he had an aphasia in the middle of the book. What is that?
Exactly. And there are other weird little things. in the book. I always have a little bit of a problem with Stephen King's depiction of women in books. They're always the helper. They're never the you know, aside from Carrie, which was his first book.
Have you read what about Cujo?
That's true. Okay, so I'm being grossly unfair.
So let's say that the women
let's just say they're rarely, or I don't know,
the women in this book.
In this book, for sure, are the helpers and the and they're also in a weird way kind of used as the emotional. The men don't have the emotions. For the emotional parts, we cut to the women. You know what I mean?
Of course.
It's like the men stifle back tears and the women are fully actualize the trauma of the whole world dying. I think that's a little bit weird. It's antiquated. It's definitely a 70s, early 80s, you know, and before, for sure. But it's definitely not a modern book, even though it's been retrofitted. And that's another thing that he that's another thing that he changed.
He put some sweet rims on.
Yeah, why does this, why are all of the metaphors that he used for this book like a car?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
tricked out my cherry book with these Boss rims.
That's right.
I souped it up.
He in the updated, the uncut version, he changed pop culture references to match the time that the book was coming out, which is around 1990.
Do you know?
So the original references were for 1980, and then he moved it up to 1990.
Do you have any idea what those are? Do you have any clue?
I wish.
Oh my god!
No, I wish I knew.
But like,
he just did a find and replace for Terminator and added a 2.
Yep, exactly.
Like if it was now, if it was like a, if it was like a Tonight Show reference, like for one edition of the book, it would be Conan, and then for the next edition of the book, it would be Jay Leno again. You know,
exactly. But the weird thing is, he's really.
It would
into
just be
music.
The whole first part of the book would just be people yelling, "Oh, this is just like the movie Outbreak!" Oh no,
exactly.
Well, you were talking. You talk about how Bad Randy runs that like fascist technocrat society.
Right.
Where is technology in the real world? But what, like when Stephen King's writing, does that make sense? Like, what is he concerned about?
Computers that control the shutdown of the virus to keep the virus in.
Okay.
In control, and that fails. Other than that, we don't see much technology, really. It's a big struggle to get electricity back once everything falls.
All right.
There are, you know, segments describing how in the Boulder community, they have a whole committee that they're trying to put together to get the power back on. And it's this sort of, it's this little race against time before winter hits to get the power back on in Boulder. So there are lots of little stresses and little pressures in this book that kind of keep the story moving. So, yeah.
Do you think it honors the Lord of the Rings in America that he set out to write?
You know, it's funny. It does in the beginning. It does in the first half of the book. When the plague is still going and when the idea is of things falling apart and then people traveling based on sort of a whim or a hope or a dream into a certain sort of toward a certain beacon that's calling them. There are some sort of outright allusions to Lord of the Rings. They feel that Randall Flagg can see them sometimes in the night and he sends out his eye, like a third eye that he sort of sends out as this spectral ability to see that they feel like an eye is watching them. So,
The eye of Randy?
The eye of Randy, yeah. Most feared. Randall Flagg's a really interesting character, though, for as weird as he is. He's a very, very bubbly, fun... psychopath.
Like Willy Wonka? Like
at times, yeah. Like there's a scene early on where somebody is dying from the flu, and he hops up on the bed and floats right above the guy who can barely breathe because he's being killed by the flu is consuming him. And he's looking for the car keys. This guy had said that he would leave car keys for Randall Flagg. And he's like hovering over the guy, and then he like is pressing on the guy's chest. He promises the cure to the flu to this guy if he gives him the keys. And then the guy gives him the keys, and he just kind of walks away. So it's this very sort of pernicious kind of like trickster in the beginning who gets more and more authoritative and evil as it goes on.
Yeah, a lot like Willy Wonka.
A lot like Willy Wonka, yeah. Just like Willy Wonka. Well, he does get very stern at the end, just like Willy Wonka did in that elevator. You know?
Yeah, that's true. That was, he was very upset with Charlie.
What did he say? Oh, you lose, right? You lose. You lose.
Craig, tell me you haven't read Charlie in the Chocolate Factory, so we can do it for this show.
I haven't read the book, no.
You haven't read the book? No. Oh, man, I know what your next book is.
Oh, man.
Oh, sweet.
Why? Stop it. Why? Why is Randall supernatural? Like, why does he need to be magic for this book to work? Or does he? Does that make sense?
He does, because for him, if he's not supernatural, nobody would know who he is. The idea of dreams being this broadcast, this sort of form of broadcast that people get a feeling from, is very, very central to the identity of the book. Everything is about dreams and who is being terrorized by things in their dreams and things like that. So,
is anybody else supernatural? Like, does he exist?
Mother Abigail.
Like, okay, right. Because she's doing the dream stuff too.
She does, yeah. She's got her dream stuff. And there's one scene where she's walking with chickens that she's killed for her guests who she knows are going to come to her in the dark. And she's very arthritic, very old. She's standing on a cane. Or she's walking with a cane. And she's surrounded.
Standing on top of a cane.
It's amazing. It's amazing. So that's magical.
She's very spry.
She's walking with this cane down this country road, and she's surrounded by hundreds of weasels who she believes the dark man has sent to kill her. And she raises her cane up in the air for a moment, and they all scatter. And you're given the impression that this was some gift from God.
And you mentioned God, like, I assume, like, the Judeo-Christian
God. This is a Judeo-Christian God, yeah.
Okay, I assume she's, like, an agent of God, and it's, like, Bad Randy, is he, like, a manifestation of the devil, or is he, like, an agent of the devil, or whatever?
He is, people make guesses on him the whole time, and some people think that he is the devil himself, some people think that he is the Antichrist, and it's never really hammered down. At the end, before he's sort of vanquished, you see this black form with his same like shining eyes right in front of the body of Randall Flagg for an instant. So you get the idea that he is definitely hanging out with the devil. Whether he's the devil or a demon or the Antichrist is pretty unclear.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get a sense of like what Stephen King is trying to say by including these supernatural elements, or if it's just like it's like he needed them to be supernatural because otherwise the story doesn't work.
Right. I think it's a little bit of both. I think that, or it's a little bit that he needed it to be supernatural. And it's a little bit that, I mean, really, the story wouldn't exist without a supernatural element to it. Or it'd be an entirely, entirely different story. It would be the first 300 pages of this book. Basically, which is a good story in and of itself. But this raises it. I think that it's very clear that he wanted to raise this to an epic story. And it gets pretty epic toward the end. So in the sort of realm of epic fantasy.
I mean, is he like trying to align technology with the devil? Is it that heavy handed? Does he not go that far?
No, that's actually, he doesn't go that far because the good people are also trying to get the technology back up and running.
Okay.
He is aligning technology with sort of like a slippery slope that mankind has created all of these things, these atom bombs, biological warfare, as a result of technology, and that in the wrong hands, things go bad.
Yeah. I mean, that's very Lord of the Ringsian too, because if you think about, I mean, I think it gets the most explicit, like right at the end when they go back to the Shire, and I'm going to spoil the Lord of the Rings for you too, just in case, just get you a twofer. They go back to the Shire, which is like their idyllic, you know, country home, and people have put up these like mills, and they're, you know, befouling the river, and they've cut down all these trees, and they've done this stuff. And like, yeah, technology is aligned with evil and with bad stuff. And, like nature is aligned with good. So yeah, in the, especially considered as a Lord of the Rings sort of tribute, that, you know, the technology thing, it's not like evil in and of itself, but people often use it to do evil things, like in the name of order or whatever.
Definitely. And that is, you don't see too much of nature in this. You see a lot of nature, as it's been sort of blasted by humanity already. You get a lot of these vistas, but then as the story starts progressing, you do see nature sort of encroaching back in on the world, which I really like. I always liked that television show, Life After Us. Did you ever see that?
Or World After People or whatever it was
called? World After People, something like that, yeah. And you get a sense of that, like the trees overgrow cars, you know, like moss grows on things and the animals start coming back. And, but it's a very short period of time. Actually, is another interesting thing to mention in this. This whole the most of the story takes place between June and November.
Whoa!
Of 1 year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's still cars and things, like you mentioned. Definitely. Gas earlier. So I'm sure people aren't just walking everywhere, because that would really.
And that's why everyone rides motorcycles, because there are cars clogged. Yeah, exactly. There are cars clogged, sort of, that clog the roadways and things. So they use motorcycles as the easiest way to get around and get through.
So, Jocko.
Yes.
Why is this book for moms?
This book is for moms because, well, one of the female characters is pregnant.
Great. And there's this sort of
worry of birth that is carried throughout the whole book. Is the baby going to be okay? Is the baby going to die when it is born? And then the further implications of that is that if this baby dies from the superflu when it's born, is this the end of life? Are these people who are immune, are they like sort of one last sort of gasp of air? Yeah. Until they die out of old age. So that's sort of that's a central theme. Also, the idea of there are a lot of mothers in this, actually. That's why this is a book for mothers, I should say. People dealing with their mothers. The woman who's pregnant has to tell, she's like pretty young, and she has to tell her mother that she's pregnant, and that's a huge scene before the plague really hits. And one of the main characters, Larry Underwood, is this famous musician, would be famous if the plague didn't hit. And he deals with his mother a lot, you know, and he constantly thinks back to his mother. And this phrase that she said, she said, "Larry, you ain't no good guy." And that like carries through with him. And he spends his whole time trying to prove his mother wrong, basically, that he is a good guy. So there's a lot of mom moments in this for sure.
All right. I didn't expect a real answer. Of an answer.
Yeah, I stumbled for a minute, but then I pulled it off. I was expecting
like moms like magic.
Nope.
You know,
a lot of moms. In this book.
It sounds like there was so much in this book. You probably couldn't ask a question and not come away with a couple of relevant examples.
Yeah,
exactly. Are there any dogs in the book?
There is one dog.
Great.
There is one dog named Kojak.
Is it Cujo?
Kojak.
Well, close.
It's the first appearance of Cujo.
Well, because it's Kojak, son of Cujo.
Exactly.
I think. With the Lord of the Rings.
Only
thing.
Dog to or that we see that has survived the plague. Domesticated animals seem to have died. So dogs and horses have all died, but cats and cows and wolves, all of those animals.
Wait,
are
domesticated
still alive.
Wolves all the domesticated wolves.
No. undomesticated animals survive. Okay. Domesticated animals die. Oh, okay. And like cats are still alive and like very happy, just like prancing around.
Sure they are, yeah.
Yeah.
Because cats will turn on you, like they will eat you if you die in your apartment.
You're food. Wait. You then become food.
Yeah. Like it doesn't matter how much they love you, they will eat you if you die.
That's a
good note to end.
Great.
On.
Yeah, if there's one lesson we could take from The Stand, it's that cats will eat you if you die.
Oh man. I was gonna ask if you thought Kojak was that maybe the dog was named something else in the first version of the book.
And then they updated it for
I don't know what would have been.
Yeah.
They updated the dog for the go-go 90s.
That's right. Kojak.
Well, thanks everyone for tuning in. And Jocko, yeah, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. This was fun. This is really, really, really long book.
Yeah.
So thanks.
Well, thank you for wading through it for us.
So, again, we are overdue. We talk about books, and if you have any recommendations or thoughts on the books we've already discussed, you can send them our way at twitter.com/overduepod or facebook.com/overduepod. You can also email us if you really felt moved to at overduepod@gmail.com.
Yeah, we also have our website up at overduepodcast.com. Up there we have links to our RSS feed and our iTunes store link, so you can, you know, click those and follow us and subscribe and get the new episodes as they come out. We also have Amazon links for the books that we read and usually the next couple of books that we read. We've been kind of remiss on that lately, and that's mostly my fault. But if you wanted to support the show, you could click those links and buy the books from Amazon, and we get a little tiny cut of that. I also wanted to say that Craig and I did a small interview for Geekadelphia, which is a local Philadelphia nerdy blog thing.
I was surprised. I thought they were just like a tech blog, and then I was surprised by how many other things they were writing about.
Yeah, it's like a lot of like culture and comics and a lot of that kind of stuff. We did the interview with them like forever ago, and they ran it in like mid to late September, and we didn't like... We didn't notice because this really did happen a while ago.
Yeah.
But if you want to see that, we've got links up on our Facebook page. And, you know, we just talk about the show and, I don't know, goof around a little bit. It's pretty fun. We had fun doing it. Yeah. So.
I don't got anything else.
I don't got anything else either. Next week, I think I'm going to change it up a little bit, Craig. And we haven't talked about this.
Uh-oh.
Well, maybe I think I might have mentioned it. But yeah, usually we're reading like novels or things that have stories. I'm going to read a book called Don't Go Back to School by Keo Stark. And it's about returning to graduate school mostly, I think. And given that, you know, we both got bachelor's degrees but then didn't go on, but we know a lot of people who did go on, yeah. I think it'll be an interesting conversation.
Great.
So
I hope so. I'm
gonna try something a little different.
Great.
Anything else?
Nope.
Nope.
Okay, everybody. Watch out for Bad Randy and try to be happy.